The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So let's see if the volume works. Is this good? I think this is good. Everyone here okay? You can hear? Okay, so for those of you who can't hear, I can tell you that there are hearing assistant devices that we have here, and they're out on the counter there. And they're wireless things you put over your ears, and this little device that you can adjust the volume for you. And sometimes I have a tendency for my voice to go very low. Some people think I get lowest when I'm going to say the most profound things. Sometimes in guided meditations, my voice goes low. So if you have trouble hearing me now, then those devices sometimes can be helpful. So, welcome. My name is Gil Fronsdal, and I think you've come to Insight Meditation Center. And people are still coming in, so I'll start with what's least important, which is say a little bit about myself. I've been involved in Buddhism and meditation since I was 19 or 20, so for my whole adult life. And it's over 40 years. And for many years, I studied Zen, practiced Zen in this country and in Japan. I was ordained as a Zen priest, a Zen monk, practiced as a monk here in this country and in Japan. And then at some point, I went to Thailand and to Burma and practiced what's called the Buddhism of Thailand and Burma. And the primary practice they teach there is a form of mindfulness called vipassana in the Buddhist language. And so I practiced there for a while as a monk, as a layperson, as a Zen priest in Burma and Thailand. Came back to this country and continued in both traditions for a while. And then in 1990, I came to Stanford to do Buddhist studies at Stanford, because that's what my life was about. And when I started in Stanford, I also started teacher training with Jack Kornfield, who is one of the first Vipassana mindfulness teachers in America. And while I was starting that teacher training in 1990, I was asked to lead a small sitting group in Palo Alto. And there were about 12, 15 people who came on Monday nights. And I started teaching, and that group slowly grew. And grew. And then in 2001, we bought this building here and moved from Palo Alto to Redwood City. And we've been very happy here, and we've continued to grow in many ways here. So now our weekly schedule is quite full. And then about 5 years ago, we started offering retreats at our own retreat center in Santa Cruz. So we have two places here and the residential retreat center in Santa Cruz. So I've been a teacher in this community for now 27 years, and I've been one of the great sources of happiness for my life. I just love the fact that I get to teach what I most love, and I've been teaching this intro class for 25, 26 years, sometimes three times a year, and it's also one of my favorite things to do. And even though I kind of say a lot of the same things every time I do it, I'm always hoping that I'm going to surprise myself, that I'll learn something new as I teach this. So we'll see if that works this time around. So this is a 5-week series where I'm going to introduce you to some of the basic practices of mindfulness as we do it here. Mindfulness now, compared to 27 years ago, has really entered our society in a big way. And they have what now called secular mindfulness, or at least that's what the Buddhists call it. That's out in clinical settings all over the country, and it's quite marvelous that this little practice of mindfulness kind of grew out of a Buddhist practice and spread out across the country. And I think there's still some value in teaching mindfulness in a Buddhist setting, which is what we do here. So it has a little bit wider context and purpose than stress reduction or some of the clinical purposes that it's often taught for. And so I'll be making references periodically to Buddhism, but for those of you who don't care about Buddhism whatsoever, or even a little bit troubled to hear the B word, just be reassured that we kind of are Buddhism light here at IMC, and we don't really care about, you know, whether you're interested in Buddhism or not. We're really interested in whether the skills, the method, the value of mindfulness is something that you can find work in your life. So the way we do it here is we do it systematically over 5 weeks, and we talk about different aspects of mindfulness. And so we'll start today with mindfulness of breathing and a little bit about the meditation posture. And then next week we'll talk about mindfulness of the body. It turns out, at least in Buddhist spirituality, being embodied, being connected to your body, is very important, not least because it's the foundation for everything else is going to follow. Some of the more deeper work of Buddhist spirituality, of potential of mindfulness. And with that foundation of mindfulness of the body and breathing, then the third week we'll cover mindfulness of emotions. Emotions are important. It's a lot easier to be mindful of emotions and know how to be with them in a wise, mindful way if you first know how to be present for your bodily experience. Then the fourth week is mindfulness of thinking. And it turns out that it's a lot easier to be mindful of thinking if you know how to be mindful of your body, be grounded in your body, and you know how to be mindful of emotions. And then the fifth week will be a little bit of a summary and a little bit of the application of this practice into daily life and some of the other ways of developing it for further wisdom. And in the process of laying out these different areas, breath, body, emotions, and thought, the principle that's behind it is that I'm trying to describe the full mandala, the full kind of range of human experiences, direct experiences in the moment, for which you can be mindful. Because the simplest way of talking about what mindfulness is, it's a relaxed recognition of what's happening in the present moment as it's happening. So very simple. So mindfulness is using nothing esoteric. It's not like some esoteric Buddhist, you know, mystical practice. It's using something my mother told me a lot growing up. She said to me, "Gil, pay attention." And I guess I didn't do that enough. So this is my adult life. I'm making up for it. It's using our simple capacity for paying attention, for being attentive, but developing it to a higher degree in a more sustained, clear, stronger way than most people ever do in their lives. Most people, when they go about their lives, we're always aware to some degree, but we're not really attentive in a conscious, kind of clear way. Some Buddhists like to say in a luminous way, you're so conscious, so aware, that it's kind of clear that you know you're aware. You know where you're at. You know what's happening. You know you're connected to yourself. You're connected to the world around you. You're not lost in your thoughts, not preoccupied with things, and, you know, so drifting off. And you're not driving down the freeway and you forget to get off at your exit because you're thinking about something. You're kind of present and here, having a conversation with someone. And you're not planning what you're going to say, and you don't hear what they're doing, what they're saying anymore. You're fully present for the experiences you're having, and there's a kind of an alertness that brings both a deep sense of relaxation and calm, but also a clarity and an intimacy to what's happening. And this calm, clear attention that we're cultivating and learning how to apply it or bring it to all aspects of our lives, in Buddhist language, is said to be very freeing. Because if we learn to be present with this kind of attention to our physical bodily experience, then we're less likely to get caught, preoccupied, troubled by what goes on in our body. And some people get troubled a lot. There's pain, there's sickness, all kinds of things. And people get get caught in the world of their thoughts, their fears, their emotions around the body. We also learn how to do the same thing with emotions. Emotions are a wonderful part of human life, but also some of the more challenging experiences people have has to do with emotions, difficult emotions. And so to learn how to have this relaxed, clear, intimate attention to emotions that both allows emotions to be there fully, but at the same time we find freedom in the midst of them, is very freeing. It's very nice. It gives space. We call it breathing room for our experience, rather than being claustrophobic or caught or pushed around by, or in the sway of our emotions. Rather than our emotions driving us, in a sense, we're in the driver's seat because we know how to pay attention. Same thing with thoughts. Rather than the thoughts being in charge, and we were kind of at the mercy of whatever we're thinking, we know how to be mindful of thinking, and because of that, there's a lot more wisdom about how to think, what we're thinking about, and the impact our thoughts have on us, and how to be free in the midst of our thinking lives. When people fully understand the mindfulness practice, the instruction becomes easier and easier. The instruction is just pay attention to everything as it's happening. But it's kind of difficult to kind of say that and just send people forth. So we do it this systematic way over these weeks. And as we do that, then the hope is that you will understand something about how it can apply to everything. There was a moment when I was learning this practice in Burma, and I've been doing this practice for some time there, and I was learning how to do it better and better, and at one point I just kind of stopped in my tracks, just stopped what I was doing, and I got so happy. And the reason I became happy was I finally understood that it was possible to be mindful of anything I was experiencing. Now, it wasn't that made me happy, but what made me happy was I knew that if I could be mindful, I could be free. And that meant, in theory, I could be free in the midst of any human experience I was having. And that potential, that possibility, inspired me greatly. It's like, wow, that possibility. And probably as we do this, some of you, maybe all of you, will also discover how you're not very free. You'll discover how you get caught by your thoughts and you can't let go of them and, they have kind of control over you. You'll learn something about your emotions and how difficult it is to be with them and how you're pushed around by them or influenced by them, conditioned by them. You'll learn something about how much you're tied to your body and affected by what goes on in your body. You're not free from it. But start getting a sense of how it's free in the midst of this is such a relief, is such an inspiring possibility. And it's the source of a wise life. It's a source of a compassionate life. It's a source of a life that is much more enjoyable to live than a life where we get caught in our experiences. So that's kind of the general plan of what we're going to do. And the reference point for especially the first 4 weeks, will be meditation practice. However, I think almost everything I teach is going to be applicable to the rest of your life as well. And as we do this teaching, a few things that you should keep in mind. You can't do the practice wrong. So don't worry about right or wrong. It makes no sense to right or wrong. It can be challenging to do it, even though you're not doing it wrong. And don't think that it's challenging only for you. It's just kind of, our minds are challenging. Our minds have had a free rein to do what they want to do for a lifetime, and it's a little bit hard to change the direction and step out of the stream of, thinking and emoting and all these things that we have. And there's a lot of catching up with ourselves. There's a lot of self-discovery we discover in this process, and some of it is not necessarily comfortable. One of the first discoveries that many people have is that their mind is out of control. And if they feel like your mind is out of control and you can't really stop it and focus on your breathing, some people get discouraged. I would encourage you to be encouraged because you just had the first insight. the first lesson. You know, now you know something you didn't know before. So it's actually useful. So you can't do it wrong, though you might be challenged, but just kind of go along, and you'll see that as we do this, it's kind of a journey, and a journey of 5 weeks, and you'll probably be different at the end of the 5 weeks than you were at the beginning. But you got to hang in there. You got to just follow through, and there'll be kind of little ups and downs as you go along. But you'll definitely, the whole thing will carry you along to a new place. Provided you do it. Because one of the things about this practice, it only works if you do it. But I want to say something about that as well. So the suggestion is that while you do this 5-week course, that you try meditating at home every day or 5 days a week. And because it's by practicing what I teach here, practicing at home, that provides you the foundation for what I'm going to teach the following week. So it's encouraged. And every week there's going to be a handout. This week it's a yellow handout. And there's a little bit of instructions of how much you should sit. I think the first week, I think it's 15 minutes a day. And then it goes up 5 minutes for the second week. And however, I know very well that some people's lives are very busy. Some people's inner life is challenging. And so sitting at home might be too difficult for you. That's okay as well. Because how I've designed this course is that some of it is teaching about meditation, about mindfulness, and some of it hopefully is a little bit of wisdom teaching, a little bit of ideas that about how to live a wise life that will stick with you and help you go through your life independent of whether you meditate. So meditate if you can. If you can't, I think the class will still be useful for you. Does that make some sense? Great. There's still people coming in, and it's getting kind of crowded on the floor here, and there's lots of space next in front of me, and I'm, you know, kind of friendly. So if you don't mind coming closer so later people can find space to come in, that would be great. So one of the, I think, underappreciated aspects of mindfulness is that mindfulness is also bodyfulness. And it's maybe unfortunate that when the people who, the English scholars in the late 1800s, who translated the Buddhist word, it's actually in ancient languages, the word is sati, S-A-T-I, translated to English as mindfulness. It might be a little bit unfortunate because it prioritizes the word mind. And in all my Buddhist training in monasteries here in Japan and Burma and Thailand, so much of it was an embodied practice. It's something you did with your body. And that's sometimes hard to understand when some people are very used to negotiating their life with their thoughts, with their head, with their mind. Nothing particularly wrong with that in and of itself, but it sometimes leads to living only half one's life. To become whole or integrated, we also have to be connected to our body. And so I like to call it bodyfulness sometimes, because there's kind of an embodied awareness, a way of being present and aware through the body. And for that purpose, when we sit and meditate, it helps to have a posture that expresses some modicum of being aware, being attentive. Some of you might have seen a baby or a photograph of a baby who's able to sit up, and sometimes they have this amazingly upright, alert spine that, you know, they're just like really, you can feel this kind of energy and alertness and presence. Like they're like paying attention, like a dog or a cat that's suddenly sitting up to pay attention. It's beautiful sometimes to watch. And some people, as they get older, their bodies start to sag and sink and, you know, curve and go down and that might be fine, except that it's not exactly a body that's attentive. You know, if you want to be attentive to a friend, you kind of show up, you know, you can show that with your body, kind of. So we want to take a posture in meditation that expresses a little bit of attentiveness. So you probably don't want to, unless you have a back problem or something, you probably don't want to kind of collapse into your couch to meditate. And if you sit in a chair, which is a fine to do, you want to be a little bit careful you don't over-rely on the backrest more than you need to, like you're resting back into it too much. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. And one of the reasons to talk about the posture first here before we start meditating is that it's unfortunate to be uncomfortable in your meditation if having sat in a better way alleviates it. So if you learn some of the very basic ideas of an aligned posture, good ways of sitting, it tends to make it a little easier in the long term. And especially if you do continue meditating for a long time, anything you do continuously, regularly, if there's a little bit of strain, that tends to build over time. So you want to start with good posture habits at the beginning. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the posture for meditation, and then you'll have a chance to stand and stretch a little bit, and then we'll do a meditation together. So the classic way of meditating, kind of image, is like the Buddha here, sitting cross-legged on the ground. And so I'll talk about that first. I actually recommend we don't sit cross-legged. So he's sitting with both legs, you know, crossed. But to sit what's called, sometimes called tailor fashion or Burmese fashion, and it's with one leg in front of the other, so that they're not actually crossing each other in any way. And that way you put less torque on the knees. And so it tends to be a lot easier in the long term that way. And it's a little bit more balanced to sit this way. As soon as you have one leg up, like half, what's called half lotus, it actually twists your body a little to one side, and you have to stretch one side more than the other to be straight. But if you sit this tailor fashion, it's a little bit more aligned. The idea is, for most people, is to sit elevated a little bit, so don't sit flat on the floor. And so many people sit on these round cushions like this, and to sit on the front third of it. So it kind of makes a little slope to tips your pelvis slightly forward, so it's easier to bring your knees down. And that's one of the functions of sitting up here, is that your knees hopefully can be touching the ground, because then you have a tripod, you have three points that support you well. If you have your knees up like this, it's a little bit more unstable. And the more stable you can be, the more it actually easier it is to settle and relax into the posture. If you have trouble getting your knees down, because some people sit like this because they can't get their knees down, but they want to sit on the floor, you can get another cushion and put it underneath, or a blanket or something, underneath your knees to support them. And that works very well for some people. Another option is to meditate on your knees. And you can get, one way to do it is to take these round cushions and stick them upright like this and put them between your ankles and sit down like this on them. And that works for people who can't sit cross-legged sometimes. Or there's also, as Kate is showing there's these benches, and that way you can sit similarly away. And that works very well for some people. People who have very open hips, they tend to be best to sit very low. If you have tight hips, sit higher in order to get the knees down. So adjusting your height is a useful thing to consider. And then you want to, the idea is to have a straight spine. And for most people, the idea is to have a teeny bit of a curve in the lower back when you sit. Not over-arched, but not completely flat either. And then to kind of build the vertebrae on top of that so they're kind of stacked in a balanced way. And one little trick of the trade is to take your hands on either side of your hips and lift yourself almost off the floor, off the cushion. And then as you put your, let go of your lifting yourself, you let your shoulders roll back. And if you do that, you're probably sitting straighter, like this. Now, if you're sitting in a chair, the classic instructions for a chair is to have both feet flat on the floor, and then parallel to each other, with your knees the same height or slightly lower than your hips. If your knees are higher than the hips, it tends to push out the lower part of the back, which causes problems over time. So you have to kind of figure out the adjustment. If you're short, then it's often nice to get some support underneath your feet. And we have some supports there in the shoe rack area for people who want to have more under their feet. If you're tall, then it's good to have a cushion on your chair so you're sitting up higher, so your knees are not, you know, higher than your hips. Some people on the chair like to have their legs out to the side wide. They feel more support that way. Whether you're sitting in the chair or sitting on the floor, you can have your hands either together, one on top of the other, or you can have them on your knees, on your thighs. If you have them all the way down on your ankles, like I'm having now, it's possible that it'll pull your shoulders forward. And over time, that might make a little strain. And so what some people will do is get some little towel or blanket or cushion and put it on top of their ankles so their hands are held higher like this. And it's a little bit easier to stay upright and not slouch that way. If you have your hands all the way in the front of your knees, that also tends to pull the shoulders forward, the back forward. And so sometimes you want to pull your hands back a little bit so that you're not... And the idea is to have the elbows kind of lined up with the sides of the ribs here, and kind of in a relaxed way. The chair also, you can kind of put your hands on either side of your hips and lift up, and that also might help you be more alert. Some people really who want to sit in chairs find it preferable not to use the backrest because it brings more alertness and a little bit more intentionality to what they're doing. Some people need to use the backrest, that's fine. But be careful you don't slouch. So you maybe want to sit, if you use the backrest, sometimes it's good to kind of go far enough back or get some extra support so you have a really firm, strong support in your lower part of your back as you're sitting there. And then the idea is the head is supposed to be balanced on the neck and shoulders. And what happens sometimes is that sometimes the head drops forward. If the head is in front of the body, the head's pretty heavy. And so it puts a big strain on the back of the muscles in your shoulder, back shoulders, and your neck. So you want to try to bring your head, you know, back a little bit, and so its ears are lined up with the shoulders. And also, some people will have to stick their chin up. And so if you're meditating with eyes closed, but then you look at your open your eyes, you'll be looking at the ceiling. So when you open your eyes, you want to have them looking down at about a 45 degrees at the floor. And then some people will tip their head or turn their head slightly. And so you want to pay a little bit of attention that the head is not a little bit crooked. And sometimes when people really get into the meditation and get kind of concentrated, sometimes they look like they're savoring it. And they're kind of like going, which is, it's fine, except that over time that'll create a strain, imbalance in the neck, and so you want to keep the head balanced. And then in our tradition, we meditate with the eyes closed. It's not required. Some teachers teach meditation with the eyes open, but if it's equal to you, then keep the eyes closed. We believe it's a little bit better for us overall. And the idea, some people will. Are very visually oriented people. And so even with their eyes closed, they're still trying to look. So they're kind of a little bit straining as if they're trying to see. And ideally, you just let the eyeballs rest in the back of the eye socket. Just kind of, you don't need to engage them at all. And some people carry a lot of tension in their jaw, and it can be helpful sometimes just drop your mouth open and then float the lips back together. So they're touching very lightly, the teeth are maybe just barely touching, and that can alleviate a little bit of that tension. It's not uncommon for people, especially on the floor, who are not used to this, for their legs to fall asleep. And usually after a few weeks of doing this regularly, that stops. And in the meantime, the main thing you have to be careful for is you don't stand up too quickly if your foot is numb, because you can lose your balance or lose your support and collapse and get hurt. So you want to make sure you have your sensations back and maybe massage your foot before you put weight on it. If it takes more than 2 or 3 minutes to get your sensations back, then it's not an issue of the blood circulation, but rather you're pinching a nerve. It's very rare, but it does happen occasionally. And if it takes more than 2 or 3 minutes, you never want to sit that way again. You never want to have that kind of numbness or that kind of pain again. So then you should find a different way of sitting. So that's the basics. And hopefully that gives you some sense of what you can do. And so if you want to stand for a minute and stretch and refresh yourself, then I'll do a guided meditation. Or those of you in the chair want to try sitting on the floor, there's still some space around here. So while we're waiting for people to come back, does any of you have any questions about the posture, what I said, and any particular things you'd like to ask?
Just hip position.
Hip.
So you said 45 degree tilt?
No, yes, yeah, so with head position, if you create a little bit of space between the last vertebrae and the skull, it tends to bring the head up, back of the head up a little bit, and the chin a little bit down. So, and it isn't so much that your head is pointing down 45 degrees, but it's kind of like your eyes are resting, and so they're kind of resting down at 45 degrees like that. So if you open your eyes, you're looking down. Other questions? We'll take a couple of minutes while waiting for people to come back from the bathroom. There are chairs in here if the people out in the outer hall prefer to be inside here. You're welcome to stay out there. So as we begin this guided meditation, I start giving you the actual instructions for mindfulness. One thing to keep in mind is that there's a difference between what you see and how and the seeing of it. What you hear and the hearing of it. What you smell and the smelling of it. What you taste and the tasting of it, what you feel with your body and the feeling of it. So, you know, I can look at this glass, the glass is what I see, but there's also the act of seeing. Right now, I'm looking at all of you and I see it in my peripheral vision. I realize it's there. And I can bring it, look, and I can look at it directly, and I clearly can see the glass, and I really know that I'm really seeing it. And I can notice a little bit how I see it. I could be studying it carefully for all its little details. I could be looking at it in a very relaxed way and just kind of take it in more generally and not study it. I could have a lot of desire for this, and I want to really enjoy it and get the most of it out of that I can. And so I'm kind of like, there's kind of a little bit of greed in looking at it. Or I could have aversion for it. There's the glass, and then there's how I look at it. What's important for the mindfulness practice is not the glass, but rather it's the seeing of it, how we see it. And we're trying to see it in a very simple, open, relaxed, clear way. Oh, it's a glass. Look at that. Not casually, too casually, but not too intently. Just, oh, it's a glass. I see it. And so what that means is that as we meditate, you'll have a variety of experiences. All kinds of things can happen here. There's the experience you have, and your knowing of that experience. Those are two different things. And what's important for mindfulness practice is not what the experience is, but rather that you know the experience. That's where the art, that's where the richness of mindfulness comes in. Many people have those two entangled, where what we know, what we're experiencing, and the knowing of it are considered the same. So what this means that as we meditate, really all you need to do is to know what's happening in a very simple way. Oh, that's what's happening. And there's no need to evaluate or judge what's at your experience as an experience. It's enough just to know, oh, this is what's happening. Oh, my mind is distracted. That's now you know. Now I know a mind that's distracted. Now my back hurts. Now there's the knowing. I know the back hurts. There's the breathing. Now I know that this is the knowing of the breathing. And so that it's in the knowing somehow where it all unfolds. So we like to say in this practice, don't worry so much about what your experience is. Some people are very focused on the experience. They want to have just the right experience. They want to do it right as an experience. They want to be successful. They want to have it pleasant. They want to avoid certain experiences. And some people are kind of experience junkies. In the mindfulness practice, your experience is not as important as the quality of the knowing that notices it, the noticing of it. So as we do this, you might see if this makes some sense to you. So, take a meditation posture that is both alert and a little bit relaxed. So that combination is a nice alert, relaxed posture. And gently close your eyes. And it's nice at the beginning of a period of meditation to do a little kind of procedure that helps you to arrive and settle in here. So you let go of some of the concerns of the day. So you might begin by taking a few long, slow, deep breaths. And as you breathe in deeply, feel the ribcage stretch and open and expand, the shoulders lift. And as you exhale, let the things relax, your body relax and settle. And then let your breathing return to normal. And take a minute or two here to scan through your body to notice if there's any places of holding or tension that you might be able to relax. Perhaps as you exhale, you can relax around the eyes and the forehead. Perhaps as you exhale, you can relax the jaws. Perhaps as you exhale, you can soften the shoulders. Soften around the shoulder blades. And as you exhale, perhaps softening the belly. Relax the belly. So then within your body, as part of your physical embodied experience, become aware of how your body experiences breathing. Perhaps aware of the movement of the chest and the rib cage as you breathe. Perhaps the movement of the belly as you breathe. Or perhaps the sensation of air going in and out through your nostrils as you breathe. Or maybe all three of those together in some way. And then see if you can become aware of the rhythm in your body, the rhythmic change of sensations as you breathe in and breathe out. And the idea is to very simply know the experience of breathing, like you're getting to know it better, like you've never really paid much attention to what it's like for the body to be breathing. Perhaps every time you exhale, letting go of your thoughts. Or let go of your concern with what you're thinking, so thinking recedes to the background. And in the foreground is the body breathing. that is to stay aware, connected to your breathing. But if anything happens that takes you away from the breathing, makes it difficult, be content to just know that. Just recognize, I'm thinking. Or I'm pulled into the world of my body and sensations, or feelings, emotions, or tiredness. And remembering that just to know is to be mindful. And then when you can, continue with your breathing. Noticing if you're thinking. And then remembering to begin again with your breathing. As you're experiencing your breathing, which seems clearest to you, the inhalation or the exhalation? Which is experienced most clearly in your body? All kinds of things can be experienced as you're meditating. All kinds of things can happen. It's enough just to notice, to know that it's happening. And in fact, there can be something compassionate about simple knowing. This is how it is now. And then coming back to your breathing. always ready to begin again with your breathing. So we'll sit for one more minute and see if you can kind of give yourself over to the breathing. So you're really there for every in-breath and out-breath, relaxing your mind, letting go of your thoughts, just breathing. So one of the reasons that we begin with breathing is that it's recognized for many people, not everyone, that breathing is calming and stabilizing. Breathing is a very simple rhythmic experience that if you can just kind of ride the rhythm of it and be with it, keep coming back to it, keep coming back. Of course the mind's going to wander off. You don't have to be frustrated that the mind wanders off. It's just what the mind does. But you can just, every time you notice, come back to your breathing. And doing that begins to disentangle us from our preoccupations, especially from the stressful way that we can be involved with our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings. And as we kind of begin stepping away or from the entanglement, from the stressful involvement, it allows the body to begin to relax and things to settle down and the mind to become more focused or more stable. And so developing a little bit of calm and stability is a great support for mindfulness, for being attentive and aware. It's a little bit like if you want to hold a telescope in your hands to look at the moon, it's kind of hard to keep it from moving, and so you stay focused on the moon. But you put the telescope on a tripod, then it's stable and you can see clearly. So having a stable mind or a calm mind helps the mindfulness not be wobbly and distractible. It's easier just to kind of stay and really, really be there. And for many people, the simplicity of the breathing is a support for that. Especially if you have some appreciation that you don't always have to be solving your problems. You don't always have to be planning. You don't always have to be remembering the past. It's okay to put it down for 10 minutes, and that'll come later. So you can just kind of put aside what you normally think about to really kind of begin to settle in and be here with the breathing. So I'm curious to hear from some of you. What was like, we sat for about 12 minutes, and what was that like? to do that little meditation, and it would be nice to hear kind of the range, because there's always going to be a range of appropriate experiences. It's all appropriate. Anybody like to share? There's a few, also, we can use the mic so we can hear. It would be helpful. We have two mics. Kate's going to get the other one.
Well, when I just came in and sat here, I kind of pulled a muscle a little bit. And the first 15 minutes of your talk, I was kind of a little bit experiencing the pain. So I still have a little pain when we started the meditation. And for me, it was like trying to see how the pain is going to distract me from focusing on the breathing, right? And so it was a little bit challenging. It's not a lot of pain, but I can feel it, uh-huh. Right? And I started, besides trying to focus on my breathing, I also was thinking, well, you know, this pain is there. It's going away and it's come back. Right? So it was a little bit of, not ideal for me, but that's what happened.
Great. So I bet there's many people here who had some kind of physical pain when they're sitting here. Next week, I'm going to talk about mindfulness of the body. We'll include discussing how to be mindful of pain and discomfort when it comes up as well. So that'll be next week. For now, since the focus is going to be on breathing, when there's physical discomfort, one option some people like to do is to kind of imagine they're breathing through the pain or breathing with the pain. Because if you can keep kind of primary attention on the breathing, but not ignore the pain, then your attention, your energy of your mind doesn't go into the thoughts about the pain. Oh, you know, this is probably the end of my life. I'm going to be a cripple. It's probably not a pulled muscle. It probably means that I have cancer and I should probably go to the doctor. And, you know, and there are all these thoughts, and the thoughts become stressful. But if you don't get pulled in, one way not to get pulled into those thoughts is just keep coming back to the breathing. But don't ignore the pain because it has your attention. Just breathe with it. Make sense? Someone else?
Well, I noticed that I'm so judgmental about my breathing and like, why? How am I supposed to breathe? And then you said the body breathing, and it's like, okay, I'm not supposed to direct the breathing, but I can't remember how I'm supposed to breathe. And so that always catches me if I try to think about my breathing.
Great. So for you, that's perfect. And so what was great was you described very well. You noticed what was going on. You clearly were mindful and noticed what's going on. And you described it very well. In mindfulness practice, that's enough. But you don't have to believe those thoughts. But you get to know, oh, look how judgmental I am. Look how I'm trying to fix it and do it right. And that probably is an interesting information about yourself and how you maybe go through the world more generally. And so here you get a chance to see it clearly. It's not a mistake that it's happening. But now you get to experiment with, can I be with that in a different way? Remember what I said, there's what you know and how you know. So what you know is you're being judgmental. Now the task is to know that you're doing that without making it the enemy, without feeling bad about yourself that you do that, but to know it in a just very simple way. Oh, look, there it is again. I'm doing it again. Ah, there it is. And you'll see over time that kind of attitude will make a world of difference. Does that make sense? So you don't have to feel bad about doing that. This is the path for you to find your way. Now, it's a very fairly common for some people to feel like they're controlling the breathing, and they have the idea that you're not supposed to. What's very nice about this mindfulness practice is we don't care whether you control it or don't control it. Certainly, it's usually more pleasant not to control it. And you usually can get a little more calmer if you don't control it. But it's okay to control it. What's important then, if a person's controlling the breath, is to just become very mindful of what it's like to control the breath. Then you're doing the practice. And then it's easier because then you're not judging yourself. I'm supposed to be doing it differently. And there was a time, a long time ago, because I was kind of grew up in the post-Eslin New Age kind of California way, that I thought that I was supposed to always have a very deep, long, relaxed breath if it was properly spiritual. And, but you can be breathing just the way you are, shallow and tight, whatever. What you'll learn if you do this mindfulness practice, if you keep it up, what you'll learn is a tremendous power and benefit of allowing yourself to be as you are, breathe as you are, but know it clearly. Oh, the breathing is tight. The breathing is short. And just, oh, this is how it is now. And see it clearly, as opposed to, oh no, I'm an embarrassment to the Buddhist world because I have this tight, narrow breathing and I'm controlling it and I'm supposed to be kind of already New Age and it's just like, you know. And then I just kind of, then I'm all wrapped up in it, right? As opposed to, oh, it's a tight, constricted breathing. That's all. It sounds kind of petty, maybe. I don't know if it's how it sounds to you when you say it this way, like kind of uninteresting, like nothing. But it makes a radical difference. It kind of undermines over time some of the neurotic ways that people spend their time in their minds. And you'll see a whole different kind of refreshed way of being in the world. So continue being judgmental. Don't worry. You'll find a way that it'll work itself out in due time. Someone else? Yes, there's a mic. No, it's also, some people can't hear well, and I can't hear well.
Okay, I found it very relaxing, and I was very aware of rhythms in breathing out, that there seemed to be three waves, and I was thinking about how breathing in seems energetic and breathing out was so relaxing, and I'm in the healthcare field, and I was thinking about sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, but it's the first time that I've ever felt that there were these waves and a rhythm to breathing out I noticed.
Yeah, that's very nice. Yes, there is. And so you can ride that, you know, and noticing that if that's kind of engaging or pleasant, you can just ride that as a way of helping you get concentrated, help the mind gets quiet. It's very nice.
Good. It was.
Yeah. See, one of the things about focusing on the breathing, I like to think of our attention as kind of like food. And it feeds wherever our attention goes. So if our attention goes to the breathing, it's not that it feeds breathing, but it feeds that ability to be mindful of the breathing. If we start thinking and the attention gets lost into the thinking, then we're actually feeding thinking. If we're kind of mindful of the breathing, but most of the attention is going to, you know, lousy me, and, you know, I can't really do this, it's too hard, then we're feeding that kind of self-criticism. So we want to be careful where the food of attention goes and where it stays. And so one of the reasons why it's relaxing to stay with the rhythm of breathing, hang out with the breathing, that's considered a very healthy place for the food of attention to go. It actually benefits us in so many different ways, as opposed to some of the other places, other things that attention can feed. So anyway, that's someone else. I appreciate hearing these comments.
Yeah, I noticed something that happens a lot, which is I think I'm very fidgety, and even when I managed to get my mind to sort of feel quiet and still, I felt like my body sort of has a mind of its own, and if I have an itch, I can't help itching it, and even if I feel still, I notice I'm moving or I'm changing my position, and then I think I build on that and get, you know, upset that I notice that I'm moving and I'm fidgeting a lot and I shouldn't be. But then I'm not sure if maybe it's okay. I guess I get sort of caught up in...
Yeah. I think for the purpose of meditation, it's helpful to keep the body still because you actually settle more deeply. It's like a tripod. You know, you can't, if it doesn't help to doing the telescope thing, and you're holding the tripod up and looking out. You know, the tripod has to be on the ground, and so ideally the body would be still, but don't worry about it. I would just, again, this tremendous benefit of just noticing that your body is fidgety, and maybe you do move, maybe you have to move, and just kind of do it all mindful. Just notice it all, and over time it'll work itself out. You'll see. Don't make it a problem. Yes, please.
Okay. This is my first time in a meditation class, but I learned meditation from a yoga class, which is teaching me when you say breathe and say I have to count 4, 4, 7, like an in for four times, count four times and hold and exhale. So I realize I keep counting it until a certain time I forgot about it and I fall asleep. I don't know if I'm doing right or wrong.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's many, many kinds of meditation. You know, if you ask someone who does, you know, some kind of sports, and you ask them, you know, what do you do? And they say, oh, I do sports. You know, you get something about them, but they could be doing curling, you know. You know, it could be almost anything, right? And so it doesn't tell you much. Same thing with word meditation. There are so many different kinds of meditation that that just people say they meditate is not, you know, have different things. So there are ways of meditating, focusing on counting. It's a little bit more of a concentration practice as opposed to a mindfulness practice. Sometimes in mindfulness practice we will do some kind of counting, but usually we don't. Mostly we sometimes do it if the mind is really out of control, to kind of quiet it down a little bit. But rather, we mostly rely on the very simple thing. Ideally, when we do mindfulness practice, it's almost like it's not a technique. It might sound like a technique, sound like you're learning a particular approach to do it, but as you mature and learn how to do this thing that I'm going to teach you, after a while it stops becoming a technique and just becomes how to be alive. It's just being aware as you're alive. It's not like a fancy thing. So counting, like you're talking about, is nice. It's a great thing to do, but you don't want to go around your whole life counting. Now I will take just maybe 5 minutes near the end to do one more short meditation, and they'll teach you a little bit of something that's kind of like counting and using what we call a mental note. In order to help us stay present more. And it's comparable to that. And maybe you'll find it as a substitute for what you do already. So in the corner back there, so where's the other mic here now?
My question is, how does the practice treat the concept of time? I had the fortune of, and also made the mistake of coming to a 45-minute meditation the other night. And I was just experiencing this 12-minute meditation in contrast to that, and I couldn't really say the other night was three times longer than this. Uh-huh. But as soon as you said, we're going to finish in about a minute, my first thought was, great. And so I'm wondering, in terms of practicing meditation, is there a concept of time, and is it, do we go into timed meditations, whether it's 45 minutes or it's an hour or two, with the concept of, okay, I'm going to be meditating for this amount of time?
Okay. So I appreciate the question a lot. Your question is very, very practical, and it has a very profound quality to it. You know, what is time and how do we relate to time? And when people meditate in such a way that they're no longer living in concepts, then they tend to go into a kind of a timeless space, because time requires conceptual thinking in some ways, some kind of reference point. And when those reference points come quiet down, the concepts and ideas, then some people feel like, wow, it's timeless. There's no time. But then they'll come out and tell their friends, you know, at 5 o'clock today, I experienced the timeless, because it happened at particular. You know, those reference points still exist. I think especially if people who are learning to meditate, it's good to have a set length of time that you're going to meditate, and to have some kind of alarm that you set for that length of time. It's pretty easy these days with smartphones that people have or other things. I think our website has a meditation timer you can download that you can set it for a different length of time, and then a bell will ring at the end so you know to end. Because if you have a set time with a bell or an alarm, then you can you don't have to be looking at your clock all the time, or you don't have to be guessing, or it's not, you don't give up too early because it's a little bit challenging or not nice. You kind of stay in there for the duration. And sometimes it's easier because some people think about time more when they're trying to time it in their own mind. But if they let the clock time them, then they can just let go of those concepts and just trust the bell. Make sense? Yeah, so is that kind of what, is that a good, adequate answer for your question? Great. Okay. So, one more? Yeah, one more, and then I'll...
I got a little bit further than I have before, in that with my breathing, I started realizing, like, I was feeling it in through, like, my skin or pulling back and forth, like, almost pulsating, except it was with the breathing. But then I'd start, as soon as I noticed that, I had to went right out of it and had to try and chase it back in again. So I was thinking just now, is it the thinking part? So you want us to notice that we're feeling it, or should I just be feeling it? Do you know what I mean?
That's also a good question. And I don't have actually a simple answer for that. So let me try to make it as simple as I can. For the purposes of mindfulness, you want to know how you're breathing. You want to know the experience. And as the practice deepens and deepens and the mind gets quieter and stiller, the knowing becomes more important. It becomes almost second nature to do. It's like almost not a technique or just what happens. But when the mind is still restless and not quite settled, some people find it helpful to not focus so much on the knowing, but to actually stay with the feeling, the sensations in the body, because that captures their attention more and they can get settled down more that way. So it's not quite mindfulness, but it can be very helpful to do that. And then once they're settled, then they'll switch over to do the mindfulness and the knowing. Does that make sense? Okay. So I'm going to say for a few minutes something about practicing at home, and then we'll do a short meditation. I think it helps the mind if you're able to meditate every day at the same time, to have a little bit of a ritual or habit or familiarity, and also to have, if you can, find a place in your home that is your meditation spot. So it can be corner of the bedroom, you know, something, some part of your house that's not strongly associated with other activities. Like, don't meditate right in front of your TV. Or in front of your refrigerator, because you know it's easy to kind of get distracted then. And but you find a place that kind of, you know, it's mostly, you don't associate with a lot of other things, and a place that's your spot. So there's a familiarity over time. Your body kind of remembers, oh, here I am. This is the spot. Oh, this is the time. And it's just easier for the whole system to begin kind of aligning itself or tuning into what you're doing. So regularity of practice is really helpful that kind of way. Now, some people can't do that for all kinds of reasons. It's fine not to do it that way. And just find time here and there as you can. But if all things are equal, it's good to have that regularity. It's good also. Some people find it traditionally, find it really nice to meditate pretty much first thing in the morning, especially if you can get up kind of early before a lot of the world begins to wake up. There's something very special some people find about before the world gets busy and, you know, a lot of traffic and things. And you know, people are at a time in the early morning when almost no one would ever call you. You know, so even if you left your phone on, you know, no one's going to call. And the world's kind of peaceful. Maybe get up and have your coffee if you need that. But you know, that some people find that. I mean, classically, that's a, you know, well practiced way of meditating to do that way. But some people that doesn't work. I had a lot of success for a long time meditating when I came home from work. So I would meditate at 6 o'clock, and it was something very special about kind of it helped me clear out the day, and by the end of the meditation. I was, the rest of the evening was so clear and alert, and I was there in a whole nice way because I had meditated and kind of cleared out the rubbish of the day that was kind of, that I carried back with me from work home. Some people find it really helpful to meditate just before go to sleep. Some people find they sleep so much more deeply that way. So there's all kinds of ways to do it, but you might want to think a little bit about if it works for you to have some regularity, a regular time, regular place, if you can. And be careful that your mind doesn't play tricks on you. And one of the tricks is going to say that something, it's really important right now to defrost the freezer. You know, I mean, it's an emergency now. So the mind can have all kinds of tricks to kind of get you to get not do it, to get distract you, and sometimes it's really, you know, one teacher says the mind has no shame. So be a little careful. The house is burning down, please get up, but, you know, it's nice to stay. You will, even though, you know, there will be challenges like with your body and things, there will be challenges with being sleepy, challenges with noise, challenges with, you know, emotions, all these things. We'll talk about that in the course as we go along over the next weeks. And hopefully with the idea, at least the principle, you understand that in the end, there's no challenges for the practice. There's just something else to notice. One of the principles we have is that there's no distractions. It's just something else to notice. And it's pretty cool if you get the hang of it. Wow, there's no distractions. Probably now you've felt distracted, some of you. I kept getting distracted from the breathing. But as you learn the practice, you know, the full scope of it, it's pretty cool to have a sense that there's no distractions. I'm just here with whatever is arising. And I can learn to be settled and present and alert and mind is quiet. And I'm just, you know, there's no distraction, just something else to notice. So we'll see how that goes along. So there is a technique that's used in our tradition called mental noting. And that is to use a very simple, rudimentary thought to help you stay present rather than having your thinking carry you away into the somewhere. And so it's kind of like giving the mind something to do, the thinking mind something to do, because an idle mind will get in trouble. So some people are just making this very, very simple note called a mental note or a mental label. And so when you're breathing, it would be as you breathe in, softly, quietly, in the back of the mind, say the word in. And as you breathe out, say the word out. Or if you're with your chest rising or your belly rising as you breathe in, you might say rising. And as the chest falls, as you exhale, falling. Exactly what the word is not that important. Generally, it's good to have something that's related to what you're paying attention to, like labeling it or a label for it. But that gives the thinking mind something to do, and it's giving it something to do that helps you stay present. Just there. It's like a little cheerleader. It says, just you, there, dear. You know, stay there with your breathing. In, out. In, out. And some people find this extremely helpful There was a long, many years where I find this very, very helpful for me to do this. And then some people find it not helpful to do it. It just seems to agitate them. So you can find your way and decide for yourself what you want to do it. But I thought for the 5 minutes here at the end, we could do this, if you'd like, this just in, out, or rising, falling. So take a meditation posture. And gently close your eyes. And as a way of beginning, you can, once again, you can take two or three deep breaths and then relax. And letting your breathing return to normal. You might also spend a few moments scanning your body to see if there's some obvious places where you can relax, soften in your body, any of the holding patterns. And then turn your attention to your breathing. Becoming aware of how your body breathes. The relaxed, easy way. And then as you breathe in, very quietly, say that either the word in or rising. And as you breathe out, say either the word out or falling. Perhaps as you exhale, you can let go of your thoughts or let them recede to the background so you can better experience breathing. And very gently, in and out. And in the last minute of this sitting, See if you can bring a deep sense of okayness with whatever is happening. Anything at all is okay. Just know it and return to your breathing. And then to end this sitting, you can take a few long, slow, deep breaths. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. There is this handout, yellow handout at the end of the stage there, that gives some written description of the instructions on mindfulness of breathing and what we're doing. It also gives some exercises, mindfulness exercises you can do in daily life. And, you know, so it's, every week you'll get one of those if you'd like. These classes are recorded, and so they will be up. We have a website called Audio Dharma. And so if you miss a class or if you want to review one of the classes, you could go there and find the under the menu under Introduction to Mindfulness class, I think it's called. As you meditate, you might see if you can experiment with not thinking of anything as a distraction, but rather, if something pulls you away from your breathing, just know it. Oh, that's what's happening. And then begin with your breathing. And it keep coming back. And it doesn't matter how many times your mind wanders off, it only matters how many times you start over on your breathing. And every time you come back to your breathing, you're changing the food of attention where it goes. And over time, it makes a big difference, because you stop feeding some of the other preoccupations that sometimes are stressful. And just kind of for this next week, the primary thing is breathing. Just experiment, develop, cultivate the ability to stay with the breathing. And with that, it'll be a lot easier for the next week when we talk about mindfulness of the body. Finally, I'd like to say that everything that we do, all the programs and teachings that we offer here at IMC, is offered freely. And so we're very happy to offer that to you. And in the context of saying that, we also like to say that you're very welcome to make a donation to what goes on here. And that's how, you know, we have this place. So what we have is a box by the door. And it has two slots. And one says operations, and that's for running the place, the facilities and the electricity and everything. And the other says teacher. And whoever is teaching here is that money goes to support the teacher. And so the teachers like me, who this is my job here, that's happens to be my income. It's quite wonderful. What's wonderful about it is that I know that my livelihood is based on people's generosity. And that's pretty cool. So it's not required, but I just want to let you know this is the system, and we're happy to offer it all freely. There's a few people here. Now, I'll stay here for a little bit. If you have any questions and want to talk to me, you can welcome to talk to me. There's a couple of people here that you might want to, also available, you can check in with if they will. Sylvia, are you available too? So why don't you stand? So if you have any questions about what I said or kind of basic meditation, you can check in with Sylvie. And Kate, who's the manager for today, you can check in with Kate, who's standing there now. And Max, are you available a little bit? You don't have to rush off. So Max is one of my co-teachers here at IMC, and he just came because I guess... Refresher. I like listening to his instruction. And, oh, and Lauren is there. So Lauren, just stand, Lauren. I didn't see you. So Lauren also is a longtime student here, and you can check in with her if you want to, you know, ask, and especially if I'm intimidating. You can. There's some people you can talk to now and ask questions or check in with them or ask about IMC or something. So did I leave anybody out? Those are the people. Okay, great. So thank you all for coming.